This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick here. Why do some young Muslim Australians turn to extremism? Why do some travel overseas and join ISIS? And how can we prevent them from going down this path?
How does a bright teenager and student of politics from Australian suburbia become a suicide bomber for Islamic State? That's the question facing authorities.
Today, the families of radicalised young men speak out. Nino Bucci is a reporter with ABC Investigations who has for many years covered crime and extremism in Victoria. Nino, in the last month in Melbourne, there have been two high-profile incidents. We saw the tragic knife attack in Bourke Street, which took the life of cafe owner Sisto Malaspina. And we also saw the arrest of three men over an alleged terror plot. Both these incidents highlight just how difficult a space this is for law enforcement and the need to get the right policy settings to identify possible assailants and prevent attacks.
That's right. Pretty much as soon as these incidents happened, there was that familiar kind of pattern of agonising about what we knew about the men and then transitioning into, okay, what can we do to prevent this happening again? So we saw, again, a bit of a conversation around encrypted apps and whether we could be a bit tighter on them. There's obviously a bill at the moment before Parliament that apparently will go some way to doing that. We saw a discussion about perhaps widening the ramifications as to when you could cancel somebody's passport. In all the cases you just mentioned, that involved men who'd had their passports cancelled because authorities suspected they were trying to join Islamic State. So you did have this kind of, you know, back and forth, as we really often see with cases of violent extremism, as to what could be done to stop it happening again.
About what law enforcement measures should we embrace in order to tackle this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
These incidents, they also prompt a search for answers. I mean, what do we know about these people?
It's really difficult to actually get, I guess, answers from the communities where these people have come from and from their families, get their insights, I suppose, as to what contributed to that. We're often left with a very one-sided narrative there, which is the law enforcement narrative, which is, you know, this is the contact we had with this person. This is what we suspected they'd been up to, and this is what we did to try and stop this from happening.
Now, you've been speaking with researchers and community leaders who are trying to get a better picture of who these people are and who's at risk.
That's right. There's a new report that's been developed in a partnership between Deakin University and Victorian Arabic Social Services. They set about interviewing family members of radicalised Australians who travelled overseas to fight in foreign conflicts. So they spoke to 12 different people from 11 different cases. They all resided in Melbourne. 9 of the 11 cases, those parents were born overseas. The majority of the families, 8 out of the 11, were Lebanese Muslim. Islam was the most common religion. 9 of the 11 families spoke both Arabic and English. So we're sort of getting a bit of a picture here that's quite typical, I guess, in our understanding of modern extremist threats in Australia. But while the demographics are not that much of a surprise, some of their insights that they give in this report are really compelling.
And it is really rare, isn't it, to get to hear from these family members?
That's right. It's incredibly rare. And it goes to the importance of an organisation like Victorian Arabic Social Services, who helped find these families and basically speak to them about their experiences, what it was like losing, you know, a young man. It was all young men that were included in this study, to violent extremism, to Islamic State. And it goes really to, you know, what their CEO, Leila Alouche, is like. She's really well connected in Melbourne's northern suburbs around Broadmeadows, where the organisation's based. She's one of those huge kind of personalities, very welcoming, generous with her time.
Sorry, can we have two good coffees?
Sort of gets everybody up, you know, kind of under her wings and brings them along with her, but, you know, super busy and super engaged in the problems in that area. And I met up with Leila at her offices in Broadmeadows, a suburb that itself is a bit of a recurring character when we talk about extremism in Australia. So we're here at Victorian Arabic Social Services in Broadmeadows. Leila, what sort of people do you see here every day?
We see people who are a new arrival who need settlement support services. We see elderly who need support. We see youth who are looking for employment or who wants to be counselled into stop drug use. We see gambling clients who want to reduce their gambling habits. We see families, victims of violence. We also do some leadership training for people who want to be leaders of others based on their life experiences and community experiences. So it's a whole range from negative to positive, from positive to negative. It's the first point of contact for people in crisis in Victoria.
So you see a huge cross-section of people with a whole range of issues, and sometimes that manifests itself as extremism.
Exactly. And so we try to do a lot of harmony building across different ethnic groups and across within the Arabic community and the Muslim community. So we do peace building activities, community harmony initiatives, work closely with Victorian and the federal police to into positive work like cyberbullying training, so people don't get bullied through cyber or recruited for the wrong things. We also do a lot of parenting education to support parents, support their kids, make the right choices. And we do early intervention programs.
As part of new Victorian government-funded research, Layla used her unique position in the local Muslim community to contact family members of radicalised Australians who travelled overseas to conflict zones for a series of rare and emotional interviews.
The families that we interviewed were very disheartened, not believing that what they have ended up experiencing, not believing that their kids made that wrong choice. So it's very emotional situations of heartbroken, disbelief, feeling unsupported by the system and by the community, feeling betrayed by the system and the community. They felt guilty, whether why haven't they picked something. So there was a bit of guilt as well on their part, saying, how come we didn't notice enough to know what's going on?
The interviews were undertaken on the basis of strict anonymity. Even then, it was difficult. Layla Alouche says a lot of people cancelled at the last minute. But the transcripts of the interviews they did manage to conduct provide raw insights. We've had them revoiced by members of the Muslim community in Broadmeadows.
He was not the person to share much information anyway, so we didn't notice much of a change. He was not normally a person who shared his thoughts or feelings with anyone. He was very quiet.
He didn't really have friends. Slowly, the school friends disappeared.
Why is it important that these stories are heard?
It's very important to hear the side of the parents, because they struggling parents, they parents who need support, and they don't agree with any of their kids' choices. They anti-terror, they very peace-loving people. They're saying it's not us, so they feel betrayals by their own kids. They're carrying now a very heavy burden that they are seen or viewed or criticised for the wrongdoing of their own children or their own choices.
What did the parents tell you about how they felt when they learned that their child had become an extremist?
They were very angry, very surprised, very disappointed. They start looking, what have we done wrong? Why haven't we picked it earlier? So there was a feeling of guilt. They want to find who the people who recruited them. They start searching into their networks, who their kids were saying, start warning other parents. My kid went that place to practice religion, do not send your kids. So they become educators as well to other friends and families of warning signs. But they were not able to identify exactly who's the people who recruited them, and that left a lot of anger in them as well.
When he was approached by extremist influencers, he started to feel less and less like he belonged. They reframed his identity and made him feel he belonged less and less. Social media puts out so much negativity about Islam, it's easy for people to say, these people don't really want me here. Why am I here?
Where's this radicalisation process occurring?
It's hard to tell because even the parents that we interviewed were very confused about it all, but they think their kids went out to cafes, they spent a lot of their time in their bedrooms with closed doors, their appearance have changed so quickly. There's multiple, but social media certainly has played as a biggest role through their radicalization process because they heard them going through on their internet and listening to extremist songs and stuff like that, but they had no control to stop it.
We read in the report that they also tend to move away from mainstream mosques and things like that.
Yes, we heard some stories where they start praying with their peers in different homes, in different locations, so they were not in mainstream Islamic structures that the families were not aware of. But they all identified that social media has played the biggest role in radicalizing them.
He had gone from obsessing about one sport or hobby to another. So while the religion part was unusual, his fasting on too and obsessing about things wasn't.
What do you think could be done to stop other children getting radicalized?
I think positive community engagement. There has to be youth funding for recreational and social and educational facilities, sport. Positive community engagement has been the main issue. And the major issue behind every story is drug addiction. This community, biggest stress to the Australian community is heavy drug use, especially ICE.
So you found that a lot of these boys that were becoming extremists also had problems with substance abuse.
Because they tried to clean themselves on the drugs and they felt, oh, well, if we do something for God, God will help us to cope with our drug addictions. So it was seen by them as a cleaning process from their drug addictions and other addictions they had. Behind every story, there is a big drug issues and it's been minimized. I cannot begin to stress how much drugs has influence. They're vulnerable people. They easily recruited because of their heavy drug use. So we need to address the drug issues and give it the highest importance in our economic decision, in our political decision, in our religious practices. Drug is number one threat to our young people in this community.
Was that surprising to you, that link between drugs and radicalisation?
Initially, I was blaming religious leaders and saying, you know, we need to watch whoever teaches them religion and things. But after the research, I'm saying we need to do both. What we discovered that it's in the school, in the sporting club, in the street, train station, in the shopping centre. So where do you let your young rebellious kids go and be safe from drug use and drug addiction?
Aside from drug abuse, there's mentions of histories of family violence, a prevalence for the extremists to be playing video games and be quite isolated. What can be done to, I suppose, sort of nip that in the bud?
What we need to get them out of their bedrooms, stop their reliance on unwanted social media and social connections and make them more physically active. And that could be free membership to gyms, sporting activities, could be even, you know, challenges, camping, positive physical and emotional activity, rewarding activity need to happen.
What do these families tell us about what authorities are getting wrong?
Some of the families that spoke to me within the research and outside the research scope have told me, well, as you knew that my son was going through that line and they haven't told me, they betrayed me. I'm an Australian citizen. I'm loyal to this country. How can they betray me? This is my son and that I'm not going to be able to see or touch or hug for life. He's dead. One woman said, I had so much trust in the system until they were observing my son going through the airport and I didn't know.
My son might have gone to the wrong group and been monitored. He was a clean and educated boy who fell in with bad influences. The police used my son as a bait to see the bigger picture on terrorism. He was used by both the traitors in IS and also by the government. I am a victim of IS recruiters and of the federal police.
You're listening to The Law Report on RN. That was a reading from one of the striking interviews with family members of Australian extremist foreign fighters. They feature throughout a fascinating new report. Nino Bucci from ABC Investigations, you've been looking closely at this issue and at this report. That particular quote, it speaks to a real sense of distrust between family members and the authorities, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's certainly a recurring theme in a lot of these interviews that somewhere there that's broken down. Now, in relation to that particular issue and authorities allowing people to travel overseas despite knowing that there was a good chance they were going to join Islamic State, neither of those federal authorities, the AFP or ASIO, were able to comment on that particular case. But having spoken with senior sources in general about that issue, they think that's unlikely. They're not aware of any cases where foreign fighters have been allowed to leave specifically so intelligence agencies or prosecution agencies like the AFP are able to gather this information about extremists. But what it certainly does go to is the fact that there's a real lack of understanding there about how this process works when you've got a family member who's become a violent extremist.
There were, in fact, a few recurring themes that seemed to run through the excerpts that we've been hearing, and also what Leela Alouche from Victorian Arab Social Services has been saying. Not only is there a distrust with authorities, but there's also a sense of isolation, abandonment. There's also a discussion of family violence and, most strikingly, drug use.
Yeah, it really speaks to how this is a multifaceted issue. We're not just talking about someone who's completely fine, normal, and then the next minute becomes a violent extremist. We're talking about people that could have become isolated, could have become withdrawn, could have gone from partying a little bit more to being more devout. You know, radicalization is a thing that I suppose in hindsight explains why that could have been important to that family member.
Nino, I'm imagining that authorities are damned if they do and damned if they don't. They're criticized if they don't take away somebody's passport. I imagine more often than not, they're criticized if they do take somebody's passport away from them. There's no winning here for authorities.
No, I guess the message that comes through from this report though is that when there's a punitive measure like that, cancelling someone's passport, there should be something else that's wrapped around it. There should be some support given to the young person and their family. And on the flip side of that, if you're aware a person is becoming radicalised but you decide not to cancel their passport, that again should be met with a little bit of, I guess, an appreciation of what that could mean for the family and the support they need. Because what these families were saying was that you guys were coming to us saying your son's being radicalised and yet you let them fly overseas. Why weren't you doing more to actually prevent it going to that next step rather than just telling us that that was happening and letting him go anyway? And questions about what we need to provide these families are at the heart of this report. I spoke to the lead researchers from Deakin University's Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation, Professor Michelle Grossman, and first, Dr. Vivian Durand.
It's very difficult for families, I think, to have trust in authorities, given that a number of families we interviewed felt very betrayed by authorities. We hear a lot about young people being prevented from travelling abroad to engage in conflict, but in our study we found a number of families had their young people allowed through with the authorities' full awareness that the children were going to engage in conflict. So the young people, they were sort of earmarked as being on their way somewhere and not stopped, and the families felt betrayed by that.
What lessons do you think there are in there from the experience of these families in terms of for law enforcement, but also for community engagement and, I guess, de-radicalisation?
There is a lot of narrative out there at the moment, for example, that says mothers, you know, are always going to know what their kids are up to before anybody else is. It's enormous pressure on mothers, I have to tell you. But we heard in our research story after story from mothers, as well as other family members, who pointed out that their children or their young relatives were actually very adept at dissembling and at hiding what they were doing. There was one case study that we dealt with where the family member said that her young person had already traveled overseas. She had no idea. And he continued to tell her that he was in Adelaide. She actually thought he was ringing from interstate when, in fact, he'd already traveled to the Middle East to participate in conflict.
I just wanted to sit in my room and cry and cry and cry and think about my brother.
if you look back and you think about particularly teenagers, the skill with which many teenagers are able to deceive their parents and deceive their families on all manner of things, you know, trivial things and banal things, as well as quite important things, in a way it's less of a surprise. So I think that was a really important lesson.
I'm not against the terrorism law. We need to protect our country. But I've discovered that the government betrayed me because they monitored my son and interviewed him at the airport and didn't advise me. They betrayed me. They should prevent the young men from going further down the wrong path, or they should involve the family to do this work.
One of the perpetual and chronic problems in this space is that when families do have concerns, when they are worried about a young person, where do they turn? Who do they actually go and talk to? If you don't have those relationships with law enforcement and with a range of non-law enforcement service providers and support services or agencies, you're really left on your own. And I think one of the lessons that law enforcement can certainly draw from this research is that early intervention, first and foremost for families, means providing support. Not necessarily what you might think of as a traditional law enforcement, you know, sort of investigation response. It is also about being law enforcement, I think, being very transparent about what the thresholds are. When is an investigation going to be unavoidable? Okay, what are the thresholds around pre-criminal versus criminal behavior that families need to understand? The more informed families and communities are, the better they will also be able to devise some of their own very creative solutions and interventions in this space. But to do that, they really need to understand. And what that means is lots more dialogue on the local level between law enforcement and families and communities.
And following on from that, feeling confident as well that law enforcement aren't going to necessarily penalise them for coming forward.
Look, I think that's absolutely right. But I think that the message about saying we're here to help and not here to harm, because the paradox, of course, is that a number of families who have agonized over whether to come forward have had to face the dilemma of saying, in order to help somebody that I care about and prevent them from harming others or themselves, am I actually going to invite greater harm by going to the authorities? And I think being able to break that nexus of assuming that there's going to be great harm if you come forward to authorities is a very, very important area for us to work on.
We're discussing a report in which family members and relatives of violent extremists have discussed their experience.
I failed my son. I pushed my kids away from religion and they went towards religion.
One of the biggest losses faced by families, aside from losing family members to conflict, was losing the support of their communities. Because once a family is identified as having some kind of affiliation with terrorism, even if they may not have known anything about it, they attract a lot of stigma and then become quite isolated from their community support networks. So I think one of the key things that has to happen, one of the things we found through this study, was giving communities support to break down the stigma. So that requires a lot of education. It requires working with community members to think about the root causes of such, you know, trajectories of violence.
And there is still a lot of taboo and mystification around violent extremism. So if you think of the difference between a family, let's say, who has somebody who's dealing with substance abuse issues or maybe dealing with mental health issues, there's much broader acceptance that those are problems that other people share, that other families share, that there are resources and supports that you can access. It's not totally without stigma, but seeking help for somebody who is radicalizing to violence is still an enormous taboo. And it means that a lot of the traditional support structures within a family or within a community are not able to be accessed. How do we, without in any way resiling from or moving away from the horrendous nature of violent extremism, its harms, the terrible impacts that it has, how do you simultaneously say this is a really, really terrible thing, but that we need to understand it and destigmatize it to the extent that people feel that they're able to come forward? If the goal is to prevent violent extremism, to prevent the kind of behavior and the kind of vulnerability that can lead people to adopt a violent extremist pathway, preventing something means understanding it first.
The extensive killing of Muslims overseas had made all our kids angry. I think that is what has motivated many of them to radicalize. Sometimes they go crazy. They lose their mind. they want to help.
We haven't seen, I guess, a lot of cases of recruiters actually being prosecuted. Is that because there's not enough of an evidence base to suggest it happens, or is it because that they don't exist in a vacuum? It's not solely one person who will cause another person to become radicalised?
I have been saying for some time that we probably have under-examined the role of recruiters in what I call the supply chain. At one end, you have a range of circumstances and conditions and vulnerabilities that can make somebody more rather than less receptive to some of the social and ideological influences that can lead to violent radicalization. And at the other end, of course, you have people who then cross that threshold into forms of violent action. In the middle are the recruiters. And we have some very interesting data, again, across a few recent studies about the role that recruiters play. However, to my knowledge, in Australia, there has been no systematic or comprehensive study to date of the role of recruiters. So recruiters are often very savvy. I compare them sometimes to international con artists and scam artists. So if you look at people who get caught up in romance scams where they part with enormous sums of money, or banking scams, or you've won the lottery and all you have to do is send me $1,000, whatever it might be, the people who are managing those scams and who are making the contact, they might as well have PhDs in human frailty and vulnerability, because they're very, very good at what they do. It's not actually so different for terrorist recruitment. So one of the things that recruiters, I think, rely on is being able to fairly quickly and also accurately target vulnerability, and then move fairly quickly to be able to work with those vulnerabilities to exercise enough social influence to convince somebody that, this is really a path worth taking. We really do need to understand more about how they operate if we are to help build resilience to that kind of recruitment. And it remains an under-researched and under-examined area.
Michelle Grossman, what do you ultimately hope will come from this research?
One of the things that already has come from this research is a really terrific community education and awareness resource that has been developed by VASSA, which is Victorian Arabic Social Services. They have piloted the resource. We understand there's been really positive feedback. And so in that sense, the research has achieved already exactly what we hoped that it would, which is bringing together a range of knowledge and insights from the families themselves who have been through these experiences that can help other families have more insight, more knowledge, more understanding, and some further practical resources. So I can't stress the importance enough of an organization like VASS or similar organizations being in a position to provide practical education, practical awareness, practical support mechanisms, and most of all, a place where people know they can turn. The more community-led services we have that are able to provide a place to bring these issues to learn more about them, and to receive the kind of support and assistance you might need, if the research has helped to achieve and grow that, then it will have amply repaid our wishes for it.
Professor Michelle Grossman from Deakin University's Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation, speaking there with her colleague and co-author, Dr. Vivian Durand. And we have a link to their report at the Law Report homepage. A big thanks to ABC Investigations' Nino Bucci and Jeremy Story Carter. Also thanks to producer Anita Barrow and sound engineer this week, Kerry Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.